Welcome to another episode of At the Table with Patrick Lencioni, where everything we talk about is related to changing the world of work so that more organizations can be more effective and less dysfunctional, and employees can be more fulfilled and less miserable. I'm your host, Pat Lencioni, joined by Cody Thompson, my regular co-host. How are you doing today, Cody?
I got downgraded from trustee to regular, so that's great.
I'm doing great. Very good. And Tracy's not here today. Karen Amador is filling in for her. How are you doing, Karen?
I'm doing great.
You have a special role today, and Matt is on the keyboard, the engineer. How you doing, Matt? Thumbs up. Good. Okay, we have a special episode today. What's it called, Cody?
14 Q's about 5 D's.
That's right. We're going to answer questions about the 5 dysfunctions. You know, we recently had a live webinar that thousands of people joined, and we talked about the 5 dysfunctions of a team, which is 20 years old. And we took questions from the audience. We had other questions. John Gordon was there, the author of The Energy Bus, a good friend of ours. And it was a great event. We really enjoyed it. We really appreciated people joining us. But we didn't get to all the questions that people had. They submitted 750 questions, and we read them all. I read the first 600. The next 150 came in after I was started preparing the day of the event. But they were fantastic. So at the end of the event, we decided, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do a special edition of this podcast, and we're going to answer the 14 questions, which really summarize the context for all the others. And that's what we're going to do in today's podcast. Karen, you're going to be asking the questions. Cody and I are going to be answering them. Mm-hmm. The questions themselves are great, and we hope you enjoy this.
All right. Ready?
Let's get started.
All right. I'm going to start with question number 14. I'm going to go up last to front. Where do you start when trying to change a culture? It's a big question.
Yeah, that's a big general question, but there's a very specific answer. And that is, you always start in one place. And that is in the room with the people that lead that organization. Sometimes people think cultural change starts with like rearranging the office or doing rebranding or having training classes or some sort of presentation. You sit down with the men and women who run that organization and you say, how do we want to behave? And do we want the rest of the organization to behave? Because culture lives in the way people act every day at work. So you start in that room, and those people have to decide how they're going to behave and drive those behaviors through the rest of the organization. So it's very, very clear. And we do this with organizations all the time, and it always has to begin there. Anything to add on that one, Cody?
You know, I'm just thinking of all the people who are listening to this who are like, well, I'm not the CEO or I'm not in that room, but I really love this stuff and I want to change the culture of maybe my team. You're absolutely right that if you're going to change the culture of the whole organization, you need it to be the leader and his or her team at the top. But I feel like we've even gone through this transition a little bit as a company where we sort of, in some ways, you can democratize this cultural transformation to team members and little pockets of the organization, where even though there's always going to be a ceiling of how much culture you can change, if you're just doing it on a sub team where the leadership team is not bought in, it's still worth doing. You know, it's still worth saying, I want my team to be cohesive and effective, or I want our team to have a cultural level of like clarity. So I think if I'm a leader listening to this and I'm like, oh man, if it has to be my CEO to buy in, what can I do? Just start, do it in your circle of influence, you know, and eventually it could actually catch on, but know that you're not going to be able to do it holistically. There's going to be a ceiling on it because the leadership's not bought in, but it shouldn't mean that you can't try. You can't do it on your team and have an influence.
You know, in the event that we were just in where we answered these questions, somebody asked a question about what were the best stories of organizations that were transformed by the 5 dysfunctions. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Donnie, a CEO of a big company, he changed the culture, even though he was running like the most troubled unit within this big company. And all he did is, instead of trying to get the CEO to change the culture, he just changed this one troubled division. And then mm-hmm. the CEO put him in charge of another troubled division, and he fixed that. And eventually, he became the CEO. But yeah, he did it by focusing on his circle of influence, not worrying about trying to change things outside of that circle of influence.
I really love this discussion and this question, because I do think, I remember you doing this thing for our consultants one time where you said, like, here's the fairy tale offsite where well, like the fairy tale, the best version of this is like we walk in and we talk to the CEO and their hearts and minds are captured by OH and then we cascade, you know, but that's like when you design it in a lab or you write it in a fairy tale. More often than not, I think it's helpful for people to hear this. It's like, this doesn't happen in a sterile laboratory. Like cultural change and the stuff that we do, it's a lot messier. And sometimes one person at a different part of the organization starts focusing on organizational health, that department starts to perform and it spills over into other teams. And they're like, other managers say, what are you doing? I want the results and the culture that you're creating. So I think there's a bunch of ways to do it. Obviously the best and most effective way is start at the top and move down. But
right.
There's no reason preventing people from doing it in their part of the organization, in their circle of influence, and then seeing how it actually spills out.
Yep. Has a viral impact. All right. Next question, Karen.
All right. So we all know that trust is at the bottom of the pyramid, and it is for a reason. So the question is, when trust has been severely damaged, how can it be rebuilt?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. It must be rebuilt, and it can't be like, let's just agree to move beyond that. Human beings have to go back and clean up the mess. And sometimes people think, man, it'd be great to start a company from scratch where people didn't have any history or any legacy incidents. But when you have a great team and then something happens, and every great team, every great marriage, every great relationship has its setbacks, you have to enter the danger and deal with it. Now, here's the good news. The good news is if you don't try to just sweep it under the rug and you actually deal with it and work through it, as painful as that is, the benefits are massive because, you know, God made us so that scar tissue heals better than tissue that's never been scarred. So a team that loses trust with one another and rebuilds it has a stronger level of trust as if they, I mean, compared to if they had never had that problem in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to just deal with it. It's messy. You got to roll up your sleeves. People have to apologize. They have to let people know how they feel. They got to work through it. But the rewards for doing that are great.
Yeah, the only thing I might add too is like, if there's an event that happens that breaks trust, the sooner you can go there and try to rebuild it, the better. Because we've worked with teams, Pat, where we were literally in a executive room, I remember, where there was an event that happened like 7 years prior that people were just, and it's sort of like, you know, when you don't answer an email in the first 3 days, and then it gets to 10 days, and you're like, well, I can't answer it now because that sounds ridiculous for me to bring that back up now, or it's a month later. It's really going to be hard if you've waited years or months, it's still worth going back and go like, I know this is so awkward to bring up now, and this happened years ago, but we really need to do this in order to heal and move forward. You've got to do it. And the advice would just be do it as fast as you can.
You know, it's funny. It's like when you break your arm or something, oftentimes you go to the doctor, they have to re-break it.
Right.
And imagine if you went there and you said, I don't think I'll go to the doctor yet. And it was 6 months later, they have to re-break it. It's going to hurt a hell of a lot more 6 months later than the day after. Exactly. So yeah, you got just do it as fast as you can. All right. Two down, 12 to go.
There you go. The next question is, what is it about vulnerability that scares most leaders in your opinion?
You know, I think this is just human nature. None of us come out of the womb wanting to be vulnerable. You know, we want to self-protect. And the idea, I think a big part of it is something that everybody I talk to says they have. I think we all have a little bit of imposter syndrome. And every leader has some little part of them that thinks, man, if they find out what I'm really all about or that I don't deserve this job, what are they going to think then? So all of us are always trying to project confidence and competence. And I think it's completely human that we think that vulnerability will possibly threaten our authority. The irony, of course, is that it's the opposite. A vulnerable leader who acknowledges their lack of competence or confidence from time to time actually gains credibility. But I think this is just human nature. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Cody? Mm-hmm. Was that brilliant, Cody? Was that just so brilliant that you couldn't possibly?
I can't follow that up. Can I go first next time? No, you're absolutely right. I think it's just like we're naturally inclined to be invulnerable. I think there's maybe an element of that too, is like what we see in TV and media most often in like leaders is this sort of like rote character who isn't vulnerable. And so maybe there's a little bit of that that plays a role. But essentially, it just boils down to not wanting to be exposed, not wanting to feel open to hurt or to not be felt like you're valuable enough to do what you're doing. You know?
Yeah. And you know, Cody, the word vulnerability is rooted in the word for wound in Latin. Mm-hmm. So it's about being open to people seeing mm-hmm. your wounds. And I think that's mm-hmm. just counterintuitive. So.
Yeah, so I know Latin too, Pat. I should have said that part. No, I'm just kidding.
In fact, let's just answer the next question in Latin.
Yeah.
There you go. Well, I was just going to follow up with the question. Do you think it's possible as a leader to be too vulnerable?
No, but you can be inappropriately vulnerable. Like you can be vulnerable in front of people that you're not supposed to be vulnerable in front of. Like being a leader that's vulnerable means in front of your team, but constantly going out on stage or in public and being vulnerable can often come across very inappropriate and insincere. It's kind of done for effect. Mm-hmm. Also, if you're constantly being vulnerable about things that aren't relevant to work, you know, I always joke about the lady who comes into work and says, "Oh, my cat has worms again." It's like, that's just too much information. You might be sad about that, but I don't think you need to tell us. So there's emotional intelligence that plays into this too. But the truth mm-hmm. is, if you've made a mistake, if you have a deficiency, the only thing you can do is put it out there. And if you're vulnerable all the time, it might be because you're incompetent and making mistakes. So the problem isn't vulnerability, it might be competence. But generally mm-hmm. speaking, no, you can't be too vulnerable. You just need to do it in the appropriate way.
Perfect.
Love it.
Okay, next question. Are the styles of leadership changing since you published the first 5 dysfunctions, which of course was 20 years ago now?
You know, Cody, we talked about this recently and you had the first take on this, and I think it's right. Why don't you go first?
Well, it just seemed like we often think of things in sort of a pendulum analogy, and things do swing from one side to the other. And if on one side, you know, I wasn't in a job 20 years ago, so you could probably speak to this a little bit more. I wasn't hanging out with a lot of leaders, but the previous sort of idea of leadership being command and control and fear, you know, fear and influence based, is that feels like an older, more common, like that's on the other side of the pendulum. And I think that in the last 20 years, it's felt like the pendulum has swung to the opposite side in some ways. And I don't know if we're at the end of that or where we are in that process, but the idea that it's way less about authoritarian, way less, you know, command and control and fear-based, and maybe even too far on the, well, let me accommodate your feelings and let's not push into each other's sandboxes or make each other feel uncomfortable. So yeah. I do think it's shifted some. What do you think?
I think it's shifted a lot. I mean, so I've been in the workforce for 32 years. Definitely, I went in thinking command and control, and which just means that you do what you're told and you suck it up and you make it work. And I didn't think it was great. I thought they could have gotten more out of me and other employees by doing it differently. And I saw that in other organizations too. I think it has swung. I'm not exactly sure why. Social changes. And I think we're in a very accommodating place. Now, yes, there are still command and control leaders in there, and there were accommodating ones before. But I think we've gotten into a place where a lot of leaders think, my job is to, and it probably has to do with the dynamics of an economy and whether it's an employer's or an employee's workplace. But I think that there's room for the pendulum to come back the other way, to where we can be a little bit more direct and a little bit more demanding of people while still respecting their personal lives and their personal needs. So yeah, I definitely think it's changed a lot. And I think it's probably going to have to come back the other way. A little.
All right, changing gears here a little bit. So the next question is, if a team or organization has a cultural value of kindness, in quotes, what advice do you have on how to approach accountability discussions?
This is a great question, and it requires us to, we love words here. I love words. And kindness is such a, we use words like be nice, be kind. Kindness is not always nice. So if it's truly kindness, and I'll use the word love, like if you're a kind person, I hope you have great love for other people, then holding people accountable, you have to do that for them, because withholding accountability and not telling somebody the truth about their performance or their behavior is unkind, right? Now, you can be nice all the time and still be unkind. And I think that happens way too much in society. I like to talk about in churches where people are nice and smiley, but they're not kind. Part of being kind is to say to somebody, hey, I think what you're doing isn't good for you. It's not good for the organization. And I want to tell you this because I care. Even if you're mad at me for telling you, I want to do it because you care. Now, you got to do it with respect. You got to do it with humility. But I think there's a lot more room for true kindness in organizations and less niceness. That's my thought.
Yeah. The other thing I love when you talk about, Pat, is the idea that, you know, this can kind of maybe play out in two of the five dysfunctions, one around conflict and one around accountability, right? So when we say, I really think one of the things that you hit on in the conflict piece is if people don't argue about ideas and give each other feedback about ideas, it ferments into conflict around people. And so I think they think that initial level of niceness of like, oh, I'm not going to disagree with you. It ends up being, you know, you use the analogy of like someone comes up with a not great idea and instead of arguing with the idea, you let it sit there and then you go out in the parking lot and tell another colleague like, well, I don't think that person's that smart. So now instead of it being a bad idea, this person's intelligence is questioned. And then that fermentation into conflict around people just is way harder to overcome than a disagreement about an idea.
Because it actually doesn't exist. It comes about because we try to be nice when we need to be kind. You know, Cody, you and I went through this just yesterday. I remember I got to work and you were out here. You were in the office yesterday visiting. Yeah. I mean, working, not visiting, but you're in Utah now. But something happened. I was kind of bothered by it. And I thought, oh, I'm not going to say anything. And I thought, that's stupid. So I said, hey, Cody, this kind of bothered me yesterday. You probably didn't mean it this way. And you go, oh, no, I didn't mean it that way. Gosh, I'm glad you said that. Okay, good. And it was gone. Yep,
totally. Mm-hmm.
And so, but it would have been easy to be like, oh, I'm not bothered by that at all. It was small.
And I'll say on this side of it, I'm like, oh, I'm so glad you told me. It would not have been on my radar that you interpreted it that way. And so I was like, oh, good. Next time that happens, I can just say, hey, here's why this is going on. You know?
So this is a day-to-day small thing. It's not like once a year. It's like little things. Like, I'm going to tell you something. And, you know, that's kind.
Very good. Well, here's another question, and it's related to conflict, actually. What is the best way to get introverted processors to engage in conflict? I can't relate to this at all.
I know.
And what about the need to process information overnight before they weigh in?
We should make you and Matt answer this question. In fact, I'm going to ask you, because I can give some advice, but Karen, so you're an introvert. Matt, you are too.
Yeah. Sure.
And when we're in a meeting, so let's say the four of us are having a conversation, Cody and I are extrovert. We're like back and forth and back and forth. How do we integrate you into conversations? Like what works for you?
You mean when we actually stop and try? You know, I'm just
when I finally get a word in edgewise, just kidding. I think introverts tend to be a little bit more restrained, as you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we don't like to talk until we're ready to talk or have actually what we think is an okay thought, you know, and safe to put it out there. So yeah, Pat, you're really good at mining for conflict, I would say. And you say like, hey, I want to hear from you or Matt. That's probably the best way. I don't necessarily need to think of things overnight. I think I can get to a conclusion sooner than that, but it does help. I think also if there's a lot of extroverts in the room, there doesn't feel like sometimes there's a lot of space for introverts to speak up.
Right.
So that's probably when I tend to be a little bit more quiet, if I'm going to be honest.
You know, it's funny. I just ask you a question off the cuff. You're an introvert. I didn't even tell you I was going to do this. Maybe a little preparation might not be a bad idea, huh? So how about you, Matt? I want to put you on the spot now.
Well, for me, I just think about like, it's easier for me to actually weigh in even on difficult, like conflict related things because there's trust, because I know that you know what my intentions are. What I'm trying to do is just get to the best possible solution and say what I think I need to say. It's the foundation of trust that allows me to actually say what I need to say without the fear of it being taken the wrong way.
Right. So that's a great thing. It's like we reduce the impact of an introvert by building trust. Mm-hmm. But asking, and Cody and I could probably do okay with people we didn't trust. We probably shouldn't because we just think out loud. But trust allows your introversion to become a little bit less of a barrier. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting. Mm-hmm. One other thing I want to say, though, is I always try to ask introverts for their opinions.
Mm-hmm. You're good at that.
I don't need to ask Cody. He doesn't need to ask me. But when I'm in a meeting, if I see an, first of all, if they say nothing, I'm going to ask them for their opinions.
Yep.
And if I see them making just a move, sometimes I'll be facilitating an executive team and there'll be an introvert in the back there and they'll open up their mouth just a little and the extroverts keep going. I'll say, stop, stop, stop. I think the introvert actually wanted to say something. Let's hear it. And it's usually profound and it blows the room away and they would not have heard it had somebody, me, in this case, the facilitator, not said, we're going to hear what you're thinking.
I think that all the things you guys touched on, the trust, like that is a great way to do that. I think I was just noticing in a meeting we had yesterday, one of the things that's sort of built into the conversations we have in meetings that I think actually lends itself to this is at almost every meeting we have, at some point, we're evaluating like which of these, we'll throw 10 things on the board and we'll say which of these things should are the right ones for us to focus on. And we, so this is like a kind of a practical, tactical way of doing it. We say, we give everyone 30 seconds and we say, you get three votes. And I think, and so we go up and we tally next to, we go around the room. So it forces introverts to get a chance to, like, we pause for a minute for them to process. And then it forces them to actually give an opinion. So that's another like tactical way that I don't know that that happens in everybody's meetings, but very regularly we seem to do that. And so it feels like we get to hear Tracy's opinion and Matt's opinion and Karen's opinion just baked into some of those small things.
Yeah. And if we didn't do that, you would get 10 votes. I would get 10 votes. Yeah. Karen would get one and Matt would get one. If we didn't actually just slightly formalize it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I do think that we have enough credibility with you guys, you know, that you actually are intentionally seeking out our opinions too. And right. I feel that.
Which gets to the trust that Matt talked about.
It's a good balance. That's gotta
get that input from introverts.
Absolutely. Okay. Have you ever encountered a certain dynamic of person or personality or attitude that will not work in a team setting?
Yeah. I think that the biggest one is just lack of vulnerability. It's like the person who just can't say I was wrong or you have a better idea or I need your help or I'm sorry. And we have run into people that just had a huge wounds or something about them that they couldn't be vulnerable. And that's the deal breaker. Other than that, what do you think, Cody? Are there other things?
Well, I mean, I think ego is the team killer, the humility piece, and that lends itself to vulnerability. People aren't vulnerable if they're not humble, you know, that they. So when we talk about the humble, hungry, smart, when you go through that model, you say, look, this, if of all these, you need humility. Now it's, you need three of three. You want people to have all of them. They're most naturally inclined to teamwork, but you are really, really wary of people who don't score high in humility.
Yeah. I mean, if a person were like off the charts lazy, that's going to be a problem, or had no social awareness. And we've all been around people like that. But I think that those people usually aren't even in the mix of being on our teams. Less so, I should say. But certainly it's the ego and the vulnerability thing. And it's the people that can fake vulnerability but don't really have it are the most dangerous. So I think that would be the answer for me.
People who are looking out for number one.
Yeah. And I'd rather have them nakedly look out for number one. So at least you can see them coming than hide it and pretend to be vulnerable and then discover it later when the damage is done.
Absolutely. Okay. Here's a big question we get. And I know we're going to do this in a future podcast, but I think this is worth just addressing right now. We're struggling to foster innovation when our workforce started working from home. So the whole virtual environment. What dysfunction is the most likely cause?
You know, Karen, you read that to me before, and as you just read it again, I listened to it in a different way, and I really understand what they were asking. And that is, yes, innovation suffers the most in a distributed or virtual work environment, and it's because the dysfunction that's at the heart of innovation, the good thing, innovation requires conflict. Anytime you're innovating or inventing or being creative, creativity requires like people wrestling with things. The creative process, and I know this as a writer, which is why I've never co-written a book with somebody other than my wife, actually. It hasn't been published yet. It was about travel. And it's there's a lot of conflict because you have to debate things and you're wrestling with things. When you're virtual, it's harder to engage in conflict. And that hurts innovation. And probably organizations that rely on innovation are probably suffering the most if they haven't gotten people back into the office. So we're going to do a podcast, Cody, in a week or two about this whole idea of virtual work and hybrid and what's the future. We want to put an end to this whole conversation and say, we want to weigh in now and say, here's how we think it should work based on what we've seen in organizations. So that's a different thing. In this question, though, I think innovation and conflict are the ones that go together.
Yeah. Mm. I think that we've never walked out of a company and thought they're having enough conflict. So most companies err on the side of too little conflict. And then you layer on top of that how difficult it is to have on Zoom. And we say that from personal experience. We told this story at the very beginning of COVID when we dispersed for a few weeks at the very beginning. Our meetings were terrible for 2 weeks. And it was because we didn't figure out how to argue. And then we remember the day where we finally were arguing over Zoom and got to a better answer. And you said,
it was me and Karen.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember it well.
And that's when you said, oh, this can maybe work. You know, it was I think that it's already the thing that is a little underrepresented, and then it just gets harder when over virtual. So you're,
I think what I said verbatim was, well, I'm going to edit this, but this stuff just got real.
Yeah.
Because we actually transitioned from nice Zoom meeting to fully human willingness to go there, but it's harder to do in two dimensions than it is in three.
Yep.
Mm. Perfect. Okay. What advice do you have as the best way to quickly onboard a new team member to the concepts and benefits of the five dysfunctions model? And this particular team says that they had already gone through some of it before this new team member came on.
Yeah, this was kind of a theme, Pat, where like, oh, we are bought into this, and it felt like every time we added a new person, it set us back in building trust. You remember that?
Right. People are like, do we have to go do a full 2-day offsite every time somebody comes on? And the answer is no. Do we just let them kind of catch on by going to meetings and watching how we act? No. Do something to recreate that 2-day offsite in an hour or two, because the cost of not doing that is a delayed productivity in this person. I mean, like we like to say, you wouldn't adopt a child and say, well, we're just going to have them come to dinner. They'll eventually catch on how things work in our family. You got to sit down and onboard and integrate a person in. Now, what we like to do, and the first place you start, is trust. Mm-hmm. So we say, you bring a new person into your team. Here's what I would do. I'll get very tactical here. First of all, show them your playbook, the answers to the six questions. You know, here's why we exist. Here's how we behave. Here, you know, go through, this is what business we're in. This is our strategy. This is our most important priorities and what we need to get done. And here's who does what on the team. Okay. Then we're going to build trust. Now, rather than going and doing the personal histories exercise the same way again, which is a great thing to do, we say, let's do this. Let's sit them down with the team and have the other members of the team reveal one another's personal histories answers. Because we've done this over the years, Karen. I can do your personal histories as well as you can do mine. And when a new member of a team sits down and says, Cody is going to tell us all about Karen's life. Here's where she grew up. Here's how many kids were in her family. Here was the most difficult challenge of her childhood. They're like, holy crap, these people really do know about each other. They're totally vulnerable. So rather than just having them go and do it again, test one another's ability to remember. And that's a really impactful thing for somebody to see on the team. And then they can share theirs.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Then use a tool. And again, the working genius thing is so much faster. You do the working genius and everybody around the table goes through. And it's great to, like, I can tell you Cody's working genius and he can tell you mine. And Karen knows my working frustrations. And when that person sees that everybody knows each other that well, then they reveal theirs. Suddenly they're like, oh, this is going to be different than the last place I worked.
Yep.
So it's repeat the trust acts exercises, review the questions from the clarity part of this. And I think you can do that in an hour and that person is going to sprint forward. Yeah, Cody?
The only thing I would add is tell stories. Like you can fast track people.
Yeah.
People into those behaviors by saying like, hey, when we say we really value vulnerability or conflict or whatever it is, say, hey, why don't you tell this story about when that happened? Or, hey, there was this event. Or, you know, I even think one of the businesses that uses our stuff, they have new hires. They have a bigger organization. So their new hires, they get a series of questions and they have to call other people in the organization and the people in the organization have to have an answer for, or like a story for each of those questions. So So that is a fast track way of saying like, hey, if you don't believe us that we're serious about conflict, let me tell you about this story where Pat and I were arguing and here's how we broke through, you know? So it just can, you don't have to recreate the wheel or you don't have to give all of the effort to get them up there. You can get them faster, like with the things that you mentioned and a few stories are going to go a long way.
I think that's great. Years ago, Nordstrom, I remember hearing that that's how they did their onboarding. They would tell stories. Instead of saying, we believe in customer service and going the extra mile, they go, here's Joe. Joe, tell him what you did for that lady last year. And people remember stories a lot better. I think that's a great way to do it. I even think you can review one another's working geniuses by telling stories. It's like Karen's a discerner and an enabler. Karen, tell him what you did for that one client. Yeah. That demonstrates your judgment and your care. So I think stories, that's a wonderful way to complement that.
Your answers combine two questions. So I'm going to, it's actually going to be 13 questions now.
Okay.
The next one is, what do you think about flat organizations?
I love flat organizations if they behave in a flat way, but if they don't have a clear leader, then it doesn't work. So I think that all organizations should behave relatively flatly as long as people know where accountability lies and who's responsible. Now, having said that, I don't like a flat organization that has one leader and 20 people working for them. Some people will say, we're flat. We have, that's no good because the span of control isn't great there. But I think when you have a team where people walking in the office can't really tell who the leader is because of the way they're working, I think that's great until there's something that happens where the leader needs to break a tie or to hold somebody accountable. Then they're willing to do that. But I think that the whole concept of flatness is more of a behavioral one than it is on an org chart. Cody, we haven't talked about that. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think when, as you were saying that, I was like, I think people, when they say flat organization, there's a difference between moral authority and formal authority. And all I really think maybe that's what they're trying to get at is like, I was a quarter owner and founder of an organization where we didn't have a leader. We had four people that had 25% ownership. It did not work. It doesn't work. You have to have a leader. But I think when they're saying flat organization, it's more a conversation about empowering other employees to like be able to make decisions and all of that. So I just don't know. You're absolutely right. You need to know who's responsible for what and have that clarity. But I like the idea of everyone feeling like they can contribute at all levels of the organization and have the clarity and direction to operate in that, in their area with the permission to do what they want to do in the guardrails that we set at the top of the organization.
Yeah. You know, you could have an organization with one leader and 19 direct reports, and the leader could act like a king or a queen and be a dictator. Or you could have an organization where there's all different kinds of levels and everything else, but people all treat each other with respect and they all dive in and help one another without a lot of regard for hierarchy. And that could actually function like a flat organization. So right. I think it's more how people behave and function rather than what it looks like on a chart.
Yep.
Three more questions. Individuals work across many teams. What advice do you have for someone who is caught in the middle when the goals differ between their teams?
Yeah, this is one that we've seen for years, this whole matrix organization and committees and task forces, blah, blah, blah. The thing is this, everybody has to know where their solid line is. And if you're working on something and somebody's asking you to do something that violates your first responsibility, you have to escalate that up. And I know people don't like that. It's like, if you feel like you're torn, escalate it fast. Go to the people one level above and say, you guys need to resolve this because I can't do that. When we make employees deeper in the organization choose between two people higher in the organization and who they're going to listen to and how they're going to do, that's one of the things that drives people crazy. So I think that when a person doesn't know who to listen to or where their bread is being buttered or who they're supposed to obey, the best thing they can do is punt that upstairs and say, you guys clarify for this for me because I shouldn't have to take the risk or be afraid that I'm going to do the wrong thing.
No comment.
Okay. Next question.
His attorney. Don't say anything about that one, Cody.
Somewhat related. If you were to give one piece of advice about handling conflict on a team where members are peers, no assigned leader, due to a member not carrying their share of the load despite attempts to communicate and plan work, what would it be? For example, a student project. So it sounds like a complicated question. I think it's actually a pretty easy one. It's a leaderless team.
Yeah. What would you say, Karen?
Well, I think that somebody has to step up.
Yeah. honestly, it would be better to arbitrarily select a leader than not to have one. Now, what would be even better is a person who is leadership capable to say, I know this is just a group project. We're going to be doing it for 6 weeks, but I'll take the responsibility for leading this if you guys will grant that to me. But a leaderless team is not a good team.
Yeah. So many kids I know have been on those projects in schools and it just doesn't work. And it always ends up being the T's that do all the work, you know?
Hey,
people with tenacity, yeah.
Yeah, no, I hate when my kids come home and go, I have a big project. Oh yeah, it's a group project. And we're like, no, because I always say, be ready to do it all if you have to, because you don't have any authority over them, but you can exercise some moral authority.
I think they're trying to show them a lesson.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how helpful it is, but okay. Final question, Pat, you just recently read your book for the first time in 7 years, I believe. So it's fresh in your mind. So the question is, knowing what you do now, or knowing what you know now, would you change any of the characters in the book?
The characters, you know, boy, I really thought about this. What would I do differently? And in reading the book, I was very surprised by it. By the way, so I haven't read it in 7 years. I didn't know what was going to happen on the next page. You know, I was like, oh yeah, I forgot about that, which is kind of cool when you write a book and you forget it. But I don't think so. I think the characters I really liked, that would be, I don't know that I would have done that. One of the things I probably would have done poorly if I'd rewrote it again is probably I would have made it longer, because I would over-explain things. And I think the fact that I kept it kind of short was a better thing. So I probably would have been tempted to, like, as I was reading it, I was like, oh man, I could have probably better explained what they were thinking in that. And I think that wouldn't necessarily have been a good thing. So I hate to say it. I really thought, I'd ask my wife, I said, come on, tell me something I should have done differently. And her response was, I think the model is simple and it's universal. And I think it works. Mm-hmm. And I think the characters do too. So I wish I had a better answer. Yeah, I would have killed off one of the characters in the first scene. Love Catherine. By the way, I wish I could be like Catherine. As I was reading it, I was like, she's great.
Yeah, she is good in that book. Well, hey, thanks for doing that, Karen. I just wanted to mention at the end of this, we hadn't planned on this before the event, but yesterday the event, you know, the content of the event was great. And we are probably going to put that up on our website as a product that people can purchase. So if you didn't get a chance to attend that event, we're going to give you a chance to purchase it on our site, watch it, and you'll see the other questions that we didn't answer on here, as well as Pat going through the content and John Gordon, you know, asking some questions around that content as well, and team. So it was a fantastic event. We'll probably have that up in the next couple of weeks. So check it out.
Yeah. All right. We appreciate you all being interested in this stuff. This was fun. Karen, thanks for jumping in and asking these questions. And we appreciate everybody listening. And this was a long podcast, longer for us, but I enjoyed it a lot. It went by fast. We'll look forward to talking to you next time on At the Table. God bless.